Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with the Honorable Terry Graffenstein, Inspector General, U.S. House of Representatives. Terry, you just have an amazing background, and I know you're really, really busy, so thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thank you very much for having me this morning. I'm really excited and at the opportunity to be able to talk with you and your audience.
Now, Terry, you broke many barriers. You've been a pioneer in many ways. And for that reason, can you profile your history prior to the current role and the defining and usable lessons that you want to share from each major event and role in your history?
Absolutely, Stephen. I guess I'll go back to college because it was very sort of defining for me. I went to a small Jesuit university in Philadelphia, St. Joseph's University. And St. Joe's really has played such a critical role in my personal and professional development. In fact, you know, I started off as a pre-med biology major, so I was a very sort of hardcore science person as a kid growing up. And so I went off to college thinking I was going to become a doctor. And that was literally until the first day they rolled in a frozen cat for dissection into my biology lab. And it was like an epiphany. I suddenly realized, you know, biology is not for me. So I ended up kind of taking a more circuitous route, and I became an accountant. I ended up getting an accounting degree. I saw it as a way to stay in a math-related field where I could likely find a job, but also not have to dissect household pets. But beyond the technical skills that I received at St. Joe's, because they had such a strong accounting curriculum, I think the most important skill that they taught me was the value of critical thinking. Real life, independent thought. It's amazing how a lot of portions of society just kind of forget the value of that. It's one of those things where you're looking at the value of understanding a problem from all sides. In fact, when I was in college, one of the main classes, aside from my sort of technical accounting classes and IT classes, was a philosophy class that required you to be able to debate an issue, sort of these deeply felt issues, from all sides. And what it did was it makes sure that you really understand a problem. It forces you to look at your biases and remove them from your argument. Sometimes it reinforces what you already believe, but sometimes it changes your mind. But it increases your chance of really coming to the right decision. It's a skill I use every day in my current role, where my opinions run deep here at the House of Representatives, and they really need an honest and unbiased assessment of risk. And so I think that my education really kind of helped me prepare for this unique environment. I think the next role that would have been critical in my development was right out of college, I started with the Department of Defense Inspector General's office as a staff-level auditor, 22 years old. It was a terrific environment to start at because it's a very large organization. There's over 1,800 auditors and investigators. So it's a terrific place to get a lot of different experiences because there's so many people, so many processes. The biggest lesson that I learned there was, as audit and accounting professionals, we have an opportunity and responsibility to use, I'll say, our powers for good. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So one of my very first projects was I visited a Marine Corps base. And when I met with the soldiers there at the Marine Corps base, the audit that I was looking at was repairable supply chains. So what does that mean? It means are they using repairable supplies to repair their big assets, their big warfighting equipment appropriately? So one of sort of the basic things that you're not allowed to do in a Department of Defense environment is it's called cannibalization of equipment. And so what that is you can't take a good item. So say you have a tank. You can't take a good tank and start using that as a source of supplies to fix other tanks that are broken. So as it turns out, this particular Marine Corps base, that's exactly what they were doing. They were cannibalizing one of their tanks. And so the easy way out for an auditor would have been simply to say, okay, the rule says this, and you're all breaking the rule, and so therefore I'm going to write it up and, you know, be on my way. And in fact, the Marines were very upfront about it. They said, we're breaking the rule here, and we want to let you know that. They were very honest about it. And so as an auditor, if I had been sort of intellectually lazy, I could have just had, you know, that could have been in the end of it, and I could have gotten home early. But what you have to do is, as an auditor, you need to step back and think, well, why are they doing this? Do these Marines go to work every day thinking, wow, how can I break the rule today? They're honestly not wired that way. They're very sort of rule-based types of folks. And so for them to be pushed into a situation where they felt like they needed to break the rules, there was an underlying problem there. What was the root cause? So as an auditor, it's our job to find that out. And so what was happening was is that they weren't being supported. The long-term supply chain wasn't supporting them. They were doing what they had to do to support the warfighter, the boots on the ground. And so as an auditor, we need to use our powers for good and make sure that we're kind of telling that story, that we're asking the questions, that we truly understand the problem from all sides. Because what I found is you can really make a difference. You could change the life of that, you know, that literally the first line level Marine. You can change the way that they're able to handle their job every day. Because an auditor has the big voice in the room. They're the ones with the reports who are going to the top echelons of whether it's the government or in private industry, whether it's the CEO. Our reports have a lot of influence. We can be heard when others cannot. So it's really an obligation to really understand a problem, and we don't lose sight of the big picture when we make a recommendation. Another role I think that's been very important in the development prior to my current position is my participation in professional organizations. The greatest lessons I've learned from my involvement with professional organizations has been the value of networking and building relationships. You know, from a practical perspective, it expands your brain power because you just have more resources to draw upon to solve problems. You can call people up and say, hey, have you seen this risk? What do you think about this new emerging technology? How are you handling this? It expands your influence and ability to attract top candidates. There's nothing like standing up on stage in one of these professional organizations in front of an audience of 200 people to kind of get the message out there. I frequently have people coming up to me afterwards saying, wow, you seem so excited about your job. You seem so excited to be involved in audit and in technology. I want to be part of that. And so it's another great way to attract top candidates because you get your name out there and people know who you are. From a personal perspective, one of the things about working on Capitol Hill is there's always a risk of kind of getting caught in this bubble. It's a very sort of insulated environment. You want to make sure that with professional organizations, it helps me to stay in touch with the latest trends. It also helps me to make sure my skills are up to date and to ensure that I stay in sync with the profession. From a big picture perspective, it also gives me an opportunity to influence the profession. For example, through my work with various professional organizations, I've been able to have input and in the development of standards by which the rest of the industry has to follow.
Oh, Terry, that's just such a remarkable history, and really you are a role model for millions around the world. And now you have this pioneering job, in essence, and you really have laid a foundation for the future in your position, really the highest position you can attain. Can you profile your current role and your measurable goals?
Absolutely, Stephen. As you know, I'm the Inspector General of the U.S. House of Representatives. In this role, I'm responsible for planning and leading independent, nonpartisan audits, advisories, and investigations of the financial and administrative functions of the House. And I think I want to underscore the nonpartisan aspect, which is very difficult sometimes in this environment because there's very deeply held opinions on both sides of just about every issue there is. One of the things that's very different and unique about my position that makes it different from almost any other position in Congress is it requires the bipartisan, unanimous consent of the House Speaker, Majority Leader, and Minority Leader. And so what that does is by getting their unanimous consent on the appointment of the Inspector General, it gives your office credibility. It shows that you're above the political fray, that you really are there as an honest broker, somebody who's an advisor who's going to make good decisions and help them to make good decisions based on risks and security vulnerabilities, those types of things, and then it's not about politics. You know, one of the things about my audit organization in particular, and that I'm very proud about, is that we run ourselves a little differently than most audit organizations. You know, audits by nature are very retrospective. They're always looking back at a point in time. The problem with that is that you identify problems after they've already occurred. You're coming in about a year later and saying, wow, that really fell off the tracks, or you really didn't handle that too well. And, you know, there's a place for that, but I think that audit organizations in general, we need to be more proactive. We need to help identify risks before they explode into full-blown crises. So I'll give you an example. There's a very sort of well-known issue in a large government organization about a year or two ago where they were deploying a system that had so many customer interfaces with the public, and it failed in a major way. So it was just sort of this public relations disaster. And I think that as an auditor, as a chief audit executive, one of our roles is to help protect our organizations from having those types of public relations disasters, help advise our organizations on problems and risks before it becomes sort of known to the rest of the world. It was interesting, they actually interviewed, after the system blew up, they actually interviewed the chief audit executive and asked them, are you going to audit this particular system? And the chief audit executive's response to that was, well, yes, we're going to audit it, and we're going to audit it twice this year. And to that I say, well, we already know what the problems are. I don't know that auditing it twice after the fact is going to help anything. It would have made a lot more sense to kind of be in there before the sort of crisis and the hit to the reputation that the organization sustained. Internally, one of the things that I'm focused on is continuous improvement. I'm constantly looking at ways to make sure that my organization is as efficient as possible. We're constantly looking at things to automate, looking at ways to streamline processes. We use technology to the greatest extent possible to make sure that we're doing things as efficiently as possible. Another thing I do is I've made significant investments in my staff through technical training to reduce reliance on contractors, which has resulted in a significant reduction in what it costs to run my organization. So we've actually been able to, over the last handful of years, we've proactively, on ourselves, nobody has asked us to do this, to flatline our budget, and we've been doing that for years. And more recently, in the current year, I actually plan to give back, it's going to be probably about 10% of my budget, because we've really made it a priority and a focus to be as efficient as possible and to really operate in the most efficient way possible. So I think we're going to be able to give back about 10% of our current budget. And then for next year's budget, I've already submitted a request to be able to reduce my budget by 7%. So it's these types of things, I think, that are really helping us in the Inspector General's office. And these are the types of things I'm measuring my success by.
You know, it's interesting, the role that you have, and it's such an important role. I guess the audience would be curious, do you get a chance to interface with all the government leaders in some way, including the president?
Well, that's an interesting question, Stephen. Well, the way that the U.S. government is structured is you have three branches of government, and so I'm in the legislative branch while the president would be in the executive branch. So I don't necessarily interface with a lot of folks in the executive branch, except for possibly my networking, through professional organizations, training events, those types of things. And no, I've never met the president. but I do get to interact with a lot of high-level officials here at the House and on both sides. And it's been a very enriching experience over the last almost 15 years that I've been here.
Now, what led you to be the first woman to achieve your position, and how can you leverage this unique history to maybe shape the planet?
That's a great question. I think the main factors that contributed to me becoming the first female Inspector General at the House were I have this willingness to reinvent myself, to kind of predict where the industry's going, where my organization's going, where the greatest risks lie, and to become that person, to make sure that I have the skills necessary to be that person. So one of the things that I saw was that IT was essentially where the industry was going. Cybersecurity is where all the risks are, especially in the government world. So I invested a lot of my personal time in developing my technical skills. I read lots and lots and lots of technical journals, I studied for relevant technical certifications. That's when I got very active in professional organizations who specialize in technology as well. I found that if you immerse yourself in what it is that you want to be, you eventually become that. You start picking up all the relevant skills that you need. There's such a value in developing a vast professional network. One of the things I also find is that how I'm going to leverage this, I think, personally, this unique history of being the first Inspector General who was a female at the House. I want to be able to get out there and, as a woman, to encourage children to enter STEM fields, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, to really get out there and show themselves that they're role models in this field, who are women, who are minorities, who people who typically or traditionally haven't been drawn to the STEM field. Kids, what I find is that kids tend to follow what they see. So if they see certain role models, that's what they want to be because that's what they know. So I think that if you, as a woman in a STEM type position and as a leader, I think it's really important for me to get out there and show myself as a role model to show kids that, wow, here's all these really exciting options that are out there. And you can do this by doing something just as simple as going to elementary school career days at high schools, kind of just getting that visibility. And the other thing is, I think with STEM careers is, you need to show that the interest and beauty of science. It's not just sort of this dry technical material. You have to show that science and technology, engineering, math, that they all let you have the tools to solve these wonderful puzzles. These world problems could be solved through the use of technology, and that these kids could have a role in this, that there's these interesting options that are out there, and they could make these meaningful contributions to the world.
You know, you've broken barriers, and as I mentioned, you're a pioneer. Have you encountered what I would call bias or even unconscious bias during your journey, or do you feel that that's getting a lot better now?
That's an interesting question. I think early on, when I first, I'll share a story. It's kind of funny. When I first graduated from college, I started off in an office with the Department of Defense Inspector General, and it was very male-dominated. I think I was one of two women who were actually hired as auditors. We were the first women in the office. And that was in 1992. That wasn't even that insanely long ago. And what was interesting about that, there was a certain amount of we were a curiosity. It was very different for the folks there who had been working there for 30 years to interact with women as colleagues and as audit professionals. And so there was a couple of funny stories, and I honestly, I didn't take them as offense. It was just sort of amusing to me. I actually had a team leader once who had said to me, you know, if you spent a little more time searching for a husband, perhaps you'd be able to stay at home and raise some children, and you know, you'd open up this position for a man who, you know, is trying to raise a family. And as offensive as that sounds now in 2012, at the time I looked at that, and I just sort of saw him as somebody who had just been, who had not kept up with the times. And he honestly, I think from his perspective, was, he thought he was giving me good advice. that, because that's what traditionally had always worked, in the environment and the era that he had grown up in. But honestly, as I kind of, went through the years, and especially here at the house, I have never sensed any bias. I felt that, being a woman neither gave me an advantage or disadvantage. I've been just treated as a professional. I'm a person who has skills, and I think that's good. I think that as we, as a society, move in that direction, that we're all just based on merit, based on skills, I think that that's true equality.
Now, Terry, I first met you at the ISACA World Congress, where you were holding many, many positions. In fact, you're a key leader, and at that Congress, speaking with Fortune 100 executives and government executives and so on, and chairing session. But I noticed there's this term honorable, and I was curious, like, can you share more about that honorable designation? I think it's just so cool.
Absolutely. It's kind of off-putting. I generally don't even use it. I think we used it in the program. But I'll give you a little example of how somebody comes up with a designation, at least in the U.S. Generally, it's somebody who has been elected to a position, so somebody who is a member of Congress, a senator, those types of things, they're going to be called the honorable and, you know, their name. Another way that you would get that designation would be to go through Senate confirmation. So a lot of the inspectors general in the executive branch who have been confirmed through the Senate have that designation because it conveys with that Senate confirmation. And sort of another way, sort of a less known way, would be here. So, for example, the House, if you're appointed to a position, so, for example, there's three House officers, Sergeant-at-Arms, the Clerk of the House, and the Chief Administrative Officer of the House. They're considered House officers. I'm sort of on their equivalent, so I'm the Inspector General of the House. And each one of these positions, because we're appointed by the House, it conveys this honorable designation.
Well, I just think it's really cool. It's kind of, to me, it's like a knighthood or something.
Right. Well, I told my mother that I wouldn't start signing my Christmas cards that way.
Now, because you have this, you know, very senior position, really the highest position possible, what are the best practices and useful lessons that you can share from your job?
Well, I think one of the most important thing would be to sort of that old saying, practice what you preach. There's nothing worse than audit organizations going out or investigative organizations going out and making recommendations and kind of finding all the doom and gloom in other or in other people, but they're not sort of minding their own P's and Q's, if you will. So one of the things I say is anytime one of my auditors comes in with a report, one of the first things I'll ask is I'll skim back to the recommendations and I'll say, well, are we doing this? And if we're not, why aren't we doing this? And if the answer is, well, that's very bureaucratic or that's very hard or that doesn't make sense, my immediate response is then why are we recommending this to somebody else? So one of the things I always try to do is to incorporate any of the recommendations I'm making to somebody else. I make sure that I'm doing it myself. And so that way you always avoid sort of the charge of hypocrisy. So I think that's one of the a big lesson that I've had. Another thing is be proactive. There's nothing worse than somebody coming after all the hard decisions have been made and all the hard work has been put in and having somebody say, wow, you really were wrong there or you really dropped the ball here. I think that you need to be as proactive as possible. Get in early so that way you can identify problems before, as I mentioned before, before they become full-blown crises. I think that's where you bring the most value if you're proactive. Another thing is it's something I like to say is don't be the king of the small. So what does that mean? It means don't throw rocks. Be constructive. Don't be this person who constantly looks at sort of the negatives. The very sort of, you might have somebody that we're auditing might have 95% of it right, and there's 5% that maybe they need to tighten down a little bit. And for us to fixate on sort of the flaws, especially if they're minimal, I think that it's just sort of, it's not constructive. It's not helpful. You lose your credibility that way. I think that you need to make sure that you're giving people credit for a job well done when you can. And then they'll take your constructive feedback better. They're going to receive a lot better, the message. Another thing I think is a useful lesson has been the importance of incorporating diversity into your organization. And so what does that mean? I think, especially in my world, where I have 435 members, they're all coming from different areas of the country, representing different types of constituencies. I think that when you have a team, diversity brings to it, and I'll kind of describe what my definition of diversity is. It's a little different than I think what most people think of when they think of diversity. But I think that the more you can connect with other people and have a broad array of opinions and backgrounds and experiences, the better you are at building relationships and improving the overall situation. People can connect with you. They can relate with you. They're more apt to share their experiences and to tell you about problems that need to be fixed. And so with diversity, one of the things I look at is that it was interesting when I first started here at the House, because the way we were formed, we were stood up in a fairly quick fashion back in 1993, 1994 timeframe. And most of the first group of auditors that were here were all coming from the Department of Transportation. And so it was interesting, while they were from a demographic perspective very diverse, men, women, different ethnicities, a lot of them, because they grew up in the Department of Transportation and IG and they had spent their careers there, a lot of them solved problems in the exact same way. And so the problem with having people who think in the exact same way is that they tend to have all the same strengths, but they also tend to have all the same weaknesses. So one of the things that I incorporate in my team is I make sure that we're hiring people who are coming from different backgrounds, private industry, former inspector general experience, people who have strong technology backgrounds, geographic regions, people are coming from all over the country, different kinds of experiences bring different values to the table. And of course, you need to have that mix of men and women, because we just think differently and we can approach people differently. And again, demographics. And so that way, because you're bringing different experiences to the table. So I think that all leads yourself to have a better team. And I think the last thing that I'd like to share would be auditors are always clamoring for, they want to have more of a say. They want to have a seat at the table, if you will, in the big decisions where they can be there in sort of the big discussions, very important discussions. But what I find a lot of times is when auditors actually finally get that seat at the table, they don't know what to do. They don't really have anything to say. They kind of sit there quietly. And a lot of times they'll cloak themselves in independence. They say, well, I can't say anything because that might violate my independence. And I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think that in order to be an effective player at some of these high-profile types of meetings, you can be a constructive advisor, be somebody who's out there proactively identifying risks and making sure the organization is taking into account controls and the types of things that we're trained in. And so I think that you need to be that constructive advisor. So that's one of the other very important lessons that I've learned in this position.
What kind of hours do you find that you put on average then? Is it sort of a typical 40-hour week, or is it like a 60 or 80-hour week?
Oh, that's a great question. It really depends. It depends on what the issues are going on, what types of projects we're doing. And so some weeks I'm having a 40-hour work week just like everybody else. Well, where other weeks it just doesn't seem to end. So it really varies significantly. The one thing I definitely am is I tend to be tethered to my historically it was always a BlackBerry. I recently switched to an iPhone, but we're attached. And so I'm constantly checking the pulse of what's going on and that sort of thing. It's almost my staff kind of jokes with me about being a bit obsessive with my email.
Carrie, you are part of the organizing committee for the ISACA World Congress in San Francisco in June. You were chairing many of the sessions. You were speaking. You were really a key figure, and you're also a key or have many key leadership roles within the organization, a very premium, very famous organization. So what are your five top takeaways from the World Congress that would provide value to, say, governments and industry and academia?
Well, you know, as you pointed out, as a conference organizer, one of the things I want to point out on the front end is that it was truly an international conference. We had so many countries represented. And I was struck by the graciousness of our speakers, and of which you were one, which we really appreciate it. Our speakers represented industry leaders from around the globe. The willingness to take time from their hectic schedules to speak, I think it's a testament to an overall willingness in the IT security and governance industry to share knowledge and experiences for the betterment of our profession. One of the things I think, though, that I learned from the World Congress was that, you know, the world is small. We truly are connected. With being such an international conference, it was interesting to see that we face the same problems regardless of our borders and our geographic locations. One of the things I found was a recurring theme was cybersecurity. You know, it impacts every single one of us. A lot of times when people think of cybersecurity, they think, well, that's the government's problem. And they think that it's sort of a nation state sponsored, types of things. But, you know, whether it's protecting a state secret or whether an organization protecting its proprietary information, or whether it's a person, just a regular citizen, making sure that our personal information is protected against theft, we all have a stake in cybersecurity. So I think that was one of the big lessons that I learned. Another thing that I found was that there's a lot of value and risk with social networking. So, for example, social networking, social media, it really gives an organization the opportunity to get its name out there in a way that it wasn't possible just, 10 years ago. You can get a lot of publicity for your product and for your organization by just getting it out there, and things become viral, as you know. And it's amazing how small organizations have the ability to take off where they otherwise wouldn't have been able to do that. But on the flip side, there's a certain risk in the sense that things get viral for good or for bad. So if a bad, some type of negative message gets out there about your organization, or if you have a rogue employee who's being not disciplined with the types of things that they're putting out in their own social media outlets and referencing your organization, it can have such a negative impact on your organization's reputation. Another thing I found was that it seems that we all share staffing issues. There seems to be a shortage of skilled technology professionals in the pipeline. And one of the things I found is that all these leaders, we all see that, and I think that we universally feel that we have a stake in ensuring the next generation is prepared to take on the evolving challenges of the 21st century. And so I think that's our biggest challenge right now as leaders, is making sure that we're getting adequate skilled professionals in the pipeline. Another area would be globalization. So as I mentioned before, the world is becoming smaller and smaller. And so as part of that is a lot of organizations that used to be a certain country based are becoming global. And the things, there's a lot of rewards to that in the sense that you can grow your organization, it results in profits, recognition, you gain a greater market share, those types of things. But there's certain risks and things that we need to be on the lookout for as we do that. So we have to be a little measured about our organizational growth. So things like, for example, if you're going from a U.S.-based organization and expanding to another country, you have to take into account cultural differences. Not everything, not all business models that may have worked in the U.S. will necessarily work in another country. Another thing would be that could get you in trouble is regulatory differences. Organizations, as they are becoming global, they need to make sure that they understand and appreciate the regulatory differences between each region of the world.
What value do you deliver in your roles with ISACA, and what measurable impact will this value have on the listening audience?
Well, you know, Stephen, I've been involved with ISACA since about 2000, and I've played so many different roles with them. And ISACA, for folks who aren't familiar with them, it's a global organization for IT audit, security, and governance professionals. Through the years, I actually started off with ISACA at the Washington, D.C. chapter in various capacities leading up to when I finally became the Washington, D.C. chapter president a number of years ago. And the D.C. chapter, it's interesting, is I think right now we're either the second or third largest chapter in the world. And it becomes like running a small business in a sense. It's a volunteer position, but essentially you're running a small business because it has thousands and thousands of members. And so the value that I think I provide, at least at the local level in that capacity, was making sure that we had low-cost training opportunities for the thousands of members that we had. And making sure that we had top-notch speakers on a recurring basis. And we actually got to the point where we have, I think it's about 3 days of training every single month going from September to May. And so that's a significant achievement considering that it's a volunteer-based organization. One of the other things I do at ISACA is I'm their chairman of the Communities Committee. And so what that is it's an online committee, that you can get at ISACA.org. And it's essentially structured into different areas of knowledge. So it's their knowledge center. And so they'll have a community that addresses cloud security. They might have one that addresses questions on COBIT, which is a framework that ISACA touts for governance. There would be another community on different regulations. There's just about anything you can think of, whether it's security, audit, governance. There's a community to address that, and it has all the associated ISACA products there. But I think more importantly, it has discussion areas where fellow professionals can ask each other, hey, have you seen this problem? I'm experiencing this. Or is anybody aware of a way to mitigate this risk? Or does anybody have an audit program that would help me to do an audit of this particular topic? And so I find that in that role, that's really been sort of groundbreaking. It's fairly new for us. It was still conceptual just about 3 years ago when I joined the Communities Committee. And now that I'm chairman, we've moved from conceptual to the actual, it's all live in production. And so I would encourage your listeners to go out and check it out. Another area that I work with ISACA is I've been on the organizing committee for the World Congress for the past 2 years. And that's actually been since inception. And that's been a terrific experience in the sense that we bring professionals from around the world to meet together to discuss problems. And one of the things that with the World Congress that we try to do that's a little different than most conferences is we really want to make it a conversation. It's not people standing up on stage speaking to PowerPoint slides and talking at you. It's a conversation. It's relaxed. It's informal. We invite the audience to participate. We want to include them. We want to make sure that we're addressing things that are important to them. So I think that that's really been a valuable contribution to the profession. And more recently, I've actually joined ISACA Strategic Advisory Council. And I'm very excited about that. I've only just been appointed to that within the last, I think it's been a month now. And so what we're doing there is I'll actually be able to help set the strategic vision for ISACA as a global organization.
Where would you like to see yourself in your ISACA sort of roles, in, let's say, in 5 years' time, and even in your professional life with the House as Inspector General? Where do you see yourself in maybe 10 years?
Well, that's a great question because it's interesting. I'll divide that up between ISACA and the House. So I guess first with the House, I had always wanted, when I first started off in the Inspector General community at age 22, I had never even considered the idea that I could eventually be an actual inspector general. It just seemed so very sort of far away and difficult. But as I kind of got closer, that became sort of the ultimate goal of my career. But having achieved that at a very young age, I was, I was just turning 40 at that point. And it seems that, wow, okay, so I've reached this point. That can't be the end of it. But I'll tell you what, I absolutely love my job. I come in here every day and I feel like that I contribute in a meaningful way. I feel like I'm so proud to work where I work. When I walk, I promise you, when I walk into that Capitol building and I look at the ceilings and the hallways and the Capitol and the inscriptions and the quotes, I just get this amazing sense of pride that I can work here, that I contribute in a meaningful way, and that I'm part of this. And I think for me, as long as I have that feeling, I want to stay here. But the minute I don't have that feeling, then I'm going to need to come up with sort of what's next for Terry. But at this point, I'm so happy here. I'm not even thinking in those terms. From an ISACA perspective, I've been with ISACA now, from chapter level all the way up through international now for about 12 years. At the international level, I've been participating with them for about the last 3+ years. I see myself in the next 5 years long, strategically, I want to grow into more of a leadership role. I really feel that I have a lot to contribute to the organization. I've been dedicated to it for so long. It's very important to me. And so it would be such an honor, to eventually, become more into a leadership role so I can help drive the overall direction of the organization. That has meant so much to me and has really given me so much in my career development.
Terry, we talked about this earlier, or at least we've touched on some of these areas and this whole idea of diversity and also women in industry. So how can we grow diversity and women in industry?
You know, Stephen, I think that it's a pipeline issue. And so what I mean is that I don't think there's a lot of women and diversity minorities in our industry, in the STEM types of fields. I think that you need to get kids interested in technology earlier in their education. So, for example, like right here in my own office, my diversity statistics for my organization are really good, but relative to the industry. And I'm very proud of my statistics in the sense that I feel like I'm very inclusive, that we're bringing in all sorts of viewpoints. However, where there's a weakness both in my industry and in my organization is in hiring specifically of Hispanic people. It's interesting in that when I realize that we're not getting a lot of applications from that particular demographic. And so it caused me to have sort of a curiosity about that. And so I dug into sort of the data, and I looked into the Bureau of Labor and Statistics. And what I'm seeing is that that particular group it seems that they're not attracted to the accounting field. And so everybody in my organization has to have an accounting degree. And so the thing with that is that if people, a certain demographic is not in the pipeline, they're not there to hire when you have a vacancy. So you can't really fix that problem at the end of the pipeline. You have to fix that at the beginning. So I think that's the general truth for all minorities in STEM fields. And that's why I think it's important to get out there. Look for opportunities to influence people when they're young, while they're still choosing their career direction. You need to let them know their options. Kids aren't going to choose it if they don't know it exists or they don't have a tangible understanding of what the job actually is. Because a lot of our jobs sound very sort of, kids know what a fireman is. They know what a doctor is because they've interfaced with those types of people. But if you tell them what an IT security professional is, their eyes are going to glaze over. They have no idea what that is. So you need to make it so that it's real for them. I think that there's so much focus on the dry mechanics of technology. When you're dealing with youngsters, you should talk about how technology can help them to solve the world's problems. You need to be excited. Make the outcomes real to them and show them that they can really have an impact by taking this career path. And to do that, I think that we need to start small. Volunteer at local schools on career day. I mean, that's just something they're always, schools are screaming for that level of adult participation. And they would be happy to have people in our career field do that. And that's something that I try to do as often as possible. Another thing that I do is, at the ISACA level, we've really strengthened. When I was chapter president, one of the things that was a goal of mine was to strengthen our academic relations program to really make sure that we're reaching out to local universities so that way we could get kids while they were still in the university and could still make decisions on what types of curriculum they were taking. And so we would make sure that we were including universities that had a very diverse student population. So I think we all have a role in this, but I think that the more attention we give it, the we're raising our chances for success.
Now, I know you've been leading initiatives within your own organization to support diversity, and you've talked about some of that already. Do you have programs outside of your organization, maybe something you're doing personally? In other words, I'm sort of looking at it from a broader standpoint. What are you doing to support diversity in many domains?
Well, what I do is that because I do have a sort of a public role in a sense where I have a lot of opportunities to speak at events, whenever I'm at any professional event, whether it's with the AICPA, ISACA, Institute of Internal Auditors, a college alumni event, even at my kids' schools, anytime I'm invited to speak anywhere, I try to get the word out about opportunities in the technology career field. I try to bring people in. We've actually started in our own organization at the House Inspector General, we've actually started an internship program. And so I'm going to try to incorporate that into these outreach efforts to give folks an opportunity to come in and to get hands-on experience. So that way it's things that they can put on their resume and make themselves more marketable. But you know what? Even when you go out and you do these speeches, it's about getting the message out there to as diverse an audience as possible. So if I'm standing up in front of 200-300 people at a technology event, they're coming from all over the place, and especially a lot of these career fairs that we do with ISACA. We'll invite local universities to come, and so these are kids who don't even know what ISACA is. And so they'll come to these. It's a free event, and we invite employers. And ISACA, we're paying for all of it. It's a way to give back to the profession. But it's also a way to help connect employers with these kids so that way they can make good career decisions. But when you get out there, you need to make it as positive as possible. So I talk about how rewarding my career field is. People want to be part of things that make them feel like they're contributing in a meaningful way. And by doing all these things, you meet people that you wouldn't otherwise meet. And if you have a positive message, you can draw them into your field. They want to get involved. They want to be part of this sort of, it's something that's interesting and something that they see that's meaningful.
In your professional activities, but also in your activities where you're contributing to all of these international organizations, you must see disruptive technologies out there that we have to be aware of. So what are your tips? What are the lessons or your forecasts of things that our audience should be watching for and how they can manage these issues associated with these technologies?
That's a great question, Stephen. You know, technology is something I love. I'm a techno geek. I love technology. But again, anything that gives us lots of rewards tends to have its own set of risks that we need to be aware of. So one of the ones I would say would be virtualization. And so that's essentially virtualization is awesome in the sense that it decreases your purchase and operating costs. It increases, you can go into rapid deployment. You can retire things a lot easier. It's a simpler enforcement of standards because you're centrally controlling things. The other thing is that you, since you're going to have more centralized control over the virtual environment, you can mandate things like security requirements and those types of things that are a little more difficult in a decentralized environment. Now the risk there though is that it's one target for a bad actor. So now they only have one place that they have to try to get into. The other area is that hardware failure. It's one thing if you have one server go down, back when we were in sort of a decentralized environment. But if there's a hardware failure in a virtualized environment, it can be catastrophic. It kind of reckons to the old days of mainframe. If the mainframe was down, it essentially shut down operations. So the other aspect is that you need to make sure, virtualization also brings into it challenges with security between virtual boxes and virtual machines. You need to make sure that you have those types of things in place. Another thing is that system administrators, when they used to be sort of on a one-server basis, they had a certain amount of information that they had access to, and there was certain risk with that. But in a virtual environment, they have access to all sorts of information. And so you need to make sure that you're really vetting those system administrators. Another area that I think that you see exploding onto the scene is the penetration of IP to just about every facet of business. It's like you can, if you have a flat screen TV on your wall, I bet you it has an IP address. Your printer in your office has an IP address. And there's so many things that you can utilize this for. It effectively knocks down all the really high and wide barriers that have been there for, say, the last 20 to 30 years. It allows services to be delivered from anywhere to anywhere. And it's just really about making sure that you have your business model in place to make sure that you really understand what you're getting yourself into, though, with all these IP addresses. Because one of the things, the main risk here I see is that the more addressable devices that you have on your network, it provides more potential entry points for a bad actor. And so that's just something that people need to be aware of. Another disruptive technology, if we're using that term, is the cloud. And we all love to talk about the cloud. And so different people have different explanations or definitions of the cloud. But I think that a cloud for established organizations, cloud provides flexibility in sourcing IT, and it builds business functionality. And it also offers the potential to provide capabilities to the cloud and not just consume from it. So you can be a consumer and a provider. But it has all these potential possibilities of making life a lot easier. And for those organizations that are not IT-centric, where that's not their core function, it's a lot easier for them to outsource sort of that function to somebody else, and so they can focus on what is really their core business. So that's a lot of sort of the good things about the cloud. Some of the security concerns or the risk, the downside, would be organizations, you know, when you go into a cloud type of relationship, obviously you're going to want to have a service level agreement in place with any of these providers. But the question always remains is, where's my data? Who actually has access to my data? Can I get to my data if I choose to change providers? How can I audit my data? And so on and so forth. And so it's those types of things that cloud services does and will always introduce a certain level of risk because you don't control the data. Another thing I think would be is very interesting, sort of on the horizon, very future, is audio and video analytics. I recently saw a demonstration by the Major League Baseball television network where they use meta tagging for all their videos. That way they can do instant analysis. It's really neat how they've incorporated that into their business model. And I see it as something there's different ways that you can do it, so there's an automated analysis of the audio and video, and it could potentially allow an organization to massively scale the amount of material that they can take advantage of. But there's certain risks to that as well. So one of the things is that all this relies on accurate tagging of data. You need to, if you're not accurately tagging it, then you're not going to get the search results, or it's going to skew your analysis. The other thing is over-reliance on automated tagging. It may not be completely accurate. And so what that could do is it leads to missing or inaccurate information for your analysis. And so I think that that's sort of that. But I think it has a lot of potential and a lot that's very interesting. Another one is, I think that would be sort of on the horizon, is natural language question answering. So if any of our listeners out there have ever watched Jeopardy, it's a general knowledge quiz show. They IBM, I think it must have been about a year or 2 years ago at this point, IBM actually had their computer out there. It's called Watson. And Watson beat the best human competitors on Jeopardy. And the Jeopardy competitors pride themselves in kind of knowing a little bit about a lot of different things. But Watson's success demonstrated a significant leap in the ability of computers to answer specific questions, rather than just sort of back in the days where you would put something into your search engine and it came back with all sorts of odd answers. Now, there's certain risks, though, with that as we, as society moves more into that. There's a risk that voice recognition, so things like, for example, on your iPhone, they have that voice recognition Siri. It's provided by someone in the cloud somewhere. And so there's also a risk that users are going to be able to be identified by whether it's their phone number, login ID, some other type of identifying piece of information. And voice samples might be able to be stored. Queries could be logged. Different user activities could be correlated. And so one of the things with that is just like with any other chunk of data, somebody is always out there, some bad actor is always out there who wants to exploit that for their own negative gains. And so I think that that's just sort of a risk that comes along with sort of this other opportunity on the horizon.
Carrie, you're a professional accountant, but you're also in the computing space, and you have the most senior position possible as Inspector General. So you're in a perfect position to answer this question. You know, we have accounting as a recognized profession. We have medicine and law. And yet we have this thing called computing, which is so essential to every aspect of our lives, and whether it's business and industry, governments, academia, media, society. What are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession, like medicine and law and accounting, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, recognized non-licensing-based credentials, perhaps, and personal accountability and responsibility, public also accountability and responsibility? What are your views on that?
Well, Stephen, other professions, as you mentioned, doctors, lawyers, engineers, accountants, other professions benefit from a certain level of formal structure and the framework that exists for them. You know, they all have formal licensing requirements, and I don't think that you're advocating or I'm advocating that that at this point that the computing profession should have some type of formal licensing process. I think that we're not mature enough to have that. But I think additional structure would benefit the profession. So, for example, if we had a framework, it would give young people who are entering the profession guidelines to work against, and this would create an efficiency in getting more more people into our pipeline. It also provides a context for outsiders who are engaging these professionals. It helps to set expectations as to what they should get in this sort of relationship with a technology professional. A framework also establishes a level of accountability. Without an established framework, it's hard to hold individuals accountable. And that's important because it reduces risk and it also encourages investment in our profession. There are subsets, actually, though, in this industry where this is actually already being done to some degree. So I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but in the U.S. government, in the Department of Defense, in the Intel community, they actually have implemented a requirement. I think it's been in place now maybe 2 to 3 years or so, where they actually require anybody who is in the IT security or governance field to actually have to obtain a certification. They actually have an approved list of certifications that they recognize. And they need to do this, whether they actually work as an employee for the Department of Defense or Intel community or as a contractor in support of those two communities. And so I think that they're actually setting a precedent in this. And so it seems like if there was a push from the overall profession, that that's sort of a direction that we can go. But clearly it's an area where the number of practitioners and the scope of work, it's run far ahead, and it can at times be the wild, wild west because we all people tend to do things differently and that sort of thing. But I think it would be a worthwhile effort to make computing a recognized profession and that has some element of demonstrated professional development and code of ethics, so that way we're all playing by the same rules and that we understand what's expected. And having some type of recognized non-licensing-based credentials. I think that that all lends to the credence and credibility of computing as a profession.
And I guess it also adds to this, so, you know, this whole idea of quality assurance. You get some guarantee, perhaps, or at least mitigates risk that you're getting some level of quality from the professionals who are working on, for example, key infrastructure items within the government or within business.
Oh, I agree, actually. And so, for example, I'm on an executive committee for the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and the AICPA sets accounting standards for the United States. And so one of the things with that is that accountants who are CPAs, they are obligated to follow a certain set of standards. And so that way, if you get an audit, a financial statement audit from a CPA, you can be guaranteed that they're obligated to follow a certain set of standards, so not making up the standards as they're going along. So it gives you, as a user of those financial statements, just to use an analogy, a certain level of assurance that you can rely on these, that they're all playing by the same rules. And so I think that that would be very useful in the technology environment.
Perry, you're famous and recognized worldwide.
I don't know about that.
You know, you're a remarkable global thought leader and also senior executive. And you have this amazing history. And from that history and from the roles that you play, both in industry and government and also in the profession, you travel extensively, you work extensively, you've seen many things around the world. Do you have any stories that you can share, maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Absolutely. I guess I'll go back to my college days. So as I mentioned before, I started off college with the Department of Defense Inspector General. And when I left, I'm a very optimistic person. I'm definitely a glass half full. I'm to this day that kind of person. But I think at 22, I was unbridled with my level of optimism, that sort of thing. But when I left college and I started with the Department of Defense Inspector General, I really left there, you know, and started in this organization thinking I was going to change the world, fighting fraud, waste, and abuse. 22 years old, we're going to save everything. I got to meet my very first general, and I was about 22, and I was so excited. I'd never met a general before, and he was a one-star, and he was in the Air Force. And so I went there. I was very nervous, and I had my little slide deck all prepared to talk to him about the audit objectives and how we were going to help him find all the problems that he had on his Air Force base and how we were going to help him, you know, solve all the world's problems and that sort of thing. And I meant it in earnest. I really did. And it was very sort of, I was very passionate. And so he listened very politely through my presentation until I got to the end. And I said, so General, I'm looking forward to working with you. And he said to me, he said, you know what you auditors are? And I said, no, sir, tell me. With these sort of open, wide-eyed expectations of words of wisdom. He said, you auditors are the ones that come in after the battle and bayonet the wounded. And so at 22, I kind of had to go through the card catalog in my head that a bayonet, wow, that's a gun with sort of a large knife at the end. This isn't good. I don't think he really thinks I'm there to help. And so it was just sort of this interesting experience early on in my career that kind of let me know that, wow, auditors really have sort of this reputation out there that we're not there to help and that people aren't really happy to see us. And so it was interesting. It leads me into sort of a second story where I came back after that. I was just sort of dumbfounded by that experience. In retrospect, I think it's hilarious. And it really did tell me a lot about the profession. But when I came back to my office and I kind of sat down with the office elders, you know, the auditors who've been auditors for 30 years, that sort of thing. And I told them, I said, can you believe that this is what happened in this meeting with my first general? And they said, oh, come on, we're going to tell you, have you heard about the two biggest lies in audit? And I was like, no, lies? I don't remember about being taught about the two biggest lies in audit when I took my auditing class in college. So, you know, what are those? And so they explained to me that the two biggest lies happen in that very first meeting when you're kicking off an audit. And so the first lie apparently is when the auditors come in and they say, hi, we're the auditors and we're here to help. And the second lie apparently is when the client or the auditee says, hi, auditors, we're so happy to see you. But it was shocking to me when they said this that the people thought those were lies because when I said them, I really meant them. I was really their help, and I thought that people were happy to see me, but apparently they weren't. But in all seriousness, though, most of us get into audit and technology because we want to help. We want to solve problems. We want to make a difference. But, you know, that's not how people see us. They see auditors as coming in after all the hard work is done, all the tough decisions have been made, and we're second-guessing. We're throwing rocks. We're bayoneting the wounded, to use the phrase of my general. No one thinks we're there to help. So, Steve, in the last 20 years I've in the IG community that I've spent here, I've really worked really hard to reverse that opinion, to show that we are there to help, that we're a partner in helping to strengthen our organizations, to identify problems before they explode, to help manage risk, to, you know, identify problems and that sort of thing. And that kind of leads me to sort of a third story, because you'd asked for three examples. A third story is I have been very successful in developing these relationships through the years and kind of turning people's opinion around of auditors, because you do that by being clear as to what you're going to do and then following up with action. Actually do what you've said you're going to do. And be transparent so people know that they can trust you, that you're somebody who doesn't go behind their back when the going gets tough, that type of thing, that you follow through. And so this is sort of a funny sort of little story. So a few years ago, I was at a Association of Government Accountants conference. And so it's a conference of 500 accountants and that sort of thing. And so it's not exactly a wild and crazy bunch, but they had a vendor there who had these pins that these sort of like little lapel pins and stuff that they were marketing their product with. And it just struck me as so funny. And that their slogan was, I heart, it was a heart symbol, I heart a good audit. And I think that nobody but an auditor would traditionally heart a good audit. Most of the time people like dread audits. And so I thought that those pins are hilarious. And so I'd asked the vendor, hey, can I take a few of these? And so I took them back with me to the house, and when I was meeting with my oversight committee, I actually had placed them face down in front of each of their place settings, and as I was before they came into the room. And so when they actually came in for me to do my briefing, it was interesting. They all looked at it, and They all laughed. They thought it was hilarious, and it was funny. It really was. They meant it to be a humorous type of thing, because non-auditors never hard a good audit. But they put them on. And so I think it was a testament to the fact that we've developed this relationship where they do value audit. They really do see it as beneficial. They see it as something that's part of the solution, that we are helping the organization mitigate risks and identify vulnerabilities before they're exploited. And so I just think that that was another sort of fun story.
You just made me laugh here. I mean, it's quite amusing, your stories. Did you ever get back to that general and change his mind?
I did not. And that's one of the downsides of working for such a large audit organization like the Department of Defense, is that you can go a whole career. There's a risk with this, though. So you can go a whole career, 30 years, without ever seeing the same person again, because it's such an enormous organization. And so for me, I'm such a relationship-based person. I like to meet people. I like to get to know them and that sort of thing. And so I felt like I wasn't getting... You never got to see that general again. It's a change his mind. And so it was just sort of this unclosed loop for me. The risk, though, is if you have an auditor who is more of the slash and burn mentality, they can get away with it for years because they never have to face that person again if they go in and they do sort of a slash and burn approach at audit. So I think there's a certain risk with those really large organizations.
You know, there's this concept of 6 degrees of separation, and because this interview is going out to millions worldwide, maybe that general will get in touch with you and say, hey.
That would be funny.
Yeah. Now, we're down to our last question, and I'm turning the tables here, Terry, and that I'm asking you, if you were conducting this interview, what 3 questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Let's see, Stephen. You know, I've talked a lot about sort of staffing and that sort of thing. I think that one of the questions I would ask myself then is, so getting the right people is probably one of the most important things we can do in an organization. So I guess I would ask myself, how do you know the candidate is the right person for your organization? I think it's kind of, I'll use an analogy with this one. I look at hiring people. It's something I do very deliberately, very methodically when we're hiring somebody, because I really look at it as entering a long-term relationship, a long-term commitment. And so I liken it to when you're going and you're buying a house, or you're going and you're getting in any type of long-term relationship. You have to do it with a certain sense of, wow, this is potentially something that's going to last a really long time, so I better make sure that this is the right decision. Earlier in my career, I had interacted with managers who looked at hiring staff as just sort of this administrative nuisance, where it was just something to be gotten out of the way. And inevitably, what would happen is that you would end up with a team member that wasn't the right fit. And that hurt them in the sense that they weren't happy. And it also hurt the team, because the team became less productive, because it's sort of this, you know, the team was off kilter. So, and I like to say to people, we wouldn't go into some other type of long-term relationship with that sort of cavalier attitude. We wouldn't say, if we were in the market to buy a house, we wouldn't say, oh, let's just drive by this house. It has a for sale sign. Let's just go with that one. That way we can just be done with it. This is a big hassle. This is taking up a lot of my time. We would never approach another long-term commitment like that. Or think about something even on a personal level. If you were, one of the things you wanted to do was get married, you would never go on a first date and say, you know, I've always wanted to get married, and we seem to get along. Let's just get married. I mean, you would never approach that type of personal commitment with that level of just being cavalier about it, just get something to be gotten out of the way. And so I think that we need to put the appropriate rigor into the hiring process to make sure we're really getting the right person, so that way they end up happy and the team ends up more productive. So some of the things I do is I've actually incorporated 3 levels of interviews into a hiring process. And so at the first level, it's if you're applying for a certain team, you would actually, that team would interview you. And so they're going to focus more on technology questions to make sure you have the technical skills that you profess to have on your resume. And so that way, by the time the candidates get out of that sort of team level interview, I have assurance that they have the technical skills that they say that they do. And the other thing is that the team who interviewed you has a stake, because they passed you on to the next level of interviews. They have a stake in your success. They want to make sure that you're a successful person if you're hired, because they've kind of given you the thumbs up. So the next level, I actually have a cross-organizational interview that involves all my sort of senior leaders, the directors. And so at that level, they're looking at things like, does this person fit in the organization? What value do they bring? If they're ever rotated to my team, does this person make sense? And at the end of the day, it's a certain amount of, this process really helps to kind of shake out the weaker candidates, people who don't necessarily have the skills that you need. And it also gets the buy-in of every single one of those senior leaders. They all want that person to succeed. And the last interview is with me. And so one of the things that I do in preparation for this last interview is I actually have them do a writing sample because a big chunk of our job is communicating a message in an audit report or an advisory report. And you can be the smartest guy in the room. I say this to my auditors all the time. You can be the smartest guy in the room, but if you can't explain it to somebody what the risks are, then it's pointless. If you can't explain why this is important and what effect's going to happen if they don't implement your recommendation, then all this is for waste. And so a writing sample will kind of give you a sense of whether or not they can string a few sentences together and effectively communicate. And the last piece, and this is just sort of interesting, what we do is we do a short, it's Myers-Briggs. Myers-Briggs is it's a personality type indicator. And I'm not doing that to weed people out. There's no right personality. But one of the things I think, I'll go back to my previous answer on diversity where I incorporate a lot of different aspects into diversity. I think you need to have a diverse pool of personalities. Because auditors, it's funny, if you look at the statistics on Myers-Briggs, auditors in general, technology people in general, all tend to be a certain personality type. For Myers-Briggs fanatics out there, ISTJ. They're almost all ISTJs. And so one of the things is if you have a staff that's completely one type of personality type, they're all going to have the same strengths, but they're all going to have the same weaknesses. And so you need to balance yourself out. Make sure that you have a team that has a big picture perspective and the folks who are really paying attention to the details. People who are very process-oriented, and then on the other side, people who really account for people, how things impact people. So that way we keep our message in a way that's diplomatic, so you're not burning bridges and you're getting a job done. People who are structured and who remind us of the rules, and other people who are a little more flexible, who are innovative and looking for new ways to do things. All of that translates into a team that's a lot more effective and brings more value to the house. So I think so that's my first question. I'm sorry it was so long. I think my second question would be, I guess since I'm in a leadership position, I would ask myself what I thought would be the key ingredients to my success. And so I think the absolute key ingredient is relationship building. And I know I'm saying this over and over again, but you can't get things done if people distrust you. They're not going to talk to you. You may get if you've done things that cause people to distrust you, you may get an answer out of them the first time, but you're not going to be able to get anything out of them the second and third times, especially in an organization where you're dealing with the same people over and over again. So you need to develop that trust. You need to follow through with what you say and don't have a hidden agenda. Another big thing is, as a secret to success, would be don't blindside people. In an audit position, I mean, it's really easy to kind of, you know, get all your data, go back into what I call the audit cave, write up your audit report, and then throw it out there over the fence as this very sort of scathing audit report and never actually talk to the person that the report's about. Well, how are they going to feel when they read that report? And the other thing is maybe there's things that you hadn't considered. Maybe there's, if they had read it ahead of time, maybe they could have said, hey, but you haven't considered this or that. So I think that it's really important to talk directly to people. Develop that relationship. Talk to them about the issues that you're finding in the report. So that way they know exactly what's going to be in there. They can tell you about anything that they've done to try to correct it, or maybe you've missed a piece of data, and you can incorporate that into your report. There's nothing wrong with giving a good message. Give them credit for their efforts. You know, audit reports don't have to be all gloom and doom. You need to give credit where you can. I think that when an audit organization does that, it adds to the credibility of your organization because it shows that you're fair and you're actually taking into account all sides. The other thing is that if you develop these relationships, people and that you develop these trusts and these types of things, a lot of times these people already know what's broken in their organization. I mean, they live this work every single day. So they're going to have a real good sense of what works and what's not working. And they'll come to you. They'll say to you, hey, I really need some help with this topic or that topic. And in fact, we've gotten to a situation, here at the house that's what happens. That's the type of relationship that we have. They come to us proactively and say, help us out with this. And sometimes it's just that auditee, needs a fresh perspective to help them identify a practical solution. And they know that you're the person who understands good internal controls. You understand security risks. And so you're going to make sure that whatever solution they come up with is taking those things into account. And at the end of the day, your organization is going to be better for it. It's going to be a more holistic approach to risk management. So I guess that's my second question. So I think my third question, because I believe you asked me for three, it would be right now with this an environment where there's such limited resources. We have, you know, economic, all these sort of economic woes across the world. You know, how does a leader continue to provide excellent service when, you know, we're being kind of pulled here, pulled there, asked to do more with less? I think that my answer to that would be, it always comes back to the right team. Make sure you're making good hiring decisions. I mean, that's going to be the foundation for everything that you do. Once you have a team, make sure that you continue to invest in them. They're going to be the people putting out the products, and you want to make sure that they're current. And so, you know, you need to give them opportunities to grow professionally and to keep their technical skills sharp. People who are happy will tend to do a better job. And so there's a variety of ways to do that. In an era of very limited resources, you know, formal training is really important. But sometimes that can be costly. If you're in a really cost prohibitive type environment, maybe formal training isn't as much of an option as it once was. But I think that you need to look around at the professionals that you have on your staff and look for learning opportunities from them. I mean, there's such a wealth of experience and expertise and skills right on your own very staff. And so one of the things I have my staff do is that they'll have the opportunity to do a class on some type of technical skill that they're proud of and that they're very good at. And so not only does it help them with honing their message and developing their presentation skills, the entire office benefits from it. So it raises sort of the ship of everybody. So it ends up working out very well. On the flip side with staff, I think that it's good to talk about all the positives, but there's always a flip side to the staff in the sense that if people aren't performing, you need to give them the opportunity to improve, but you need to hold them accountable. I think a lot of times people are afraid or reluctant to address poor performance problems, and I think that's a mistake. It's not good for the organization. If they can or won't meet performance standards, sometimes you're going to need to cut them loose for the health of the organization. There's nothing worse for the morale of high-performing staff than to have to carry the weight of somebody else on the team who's just not performing. And the other thing is, I think you need to be a leader that people actually want to follow. That involves things like courage. And so you may think, okay, what's courage? When you think of courage, people will think of somebody like a police officer or a soldier, because obviously those types of roles are very courageous. But courage, a leader in just a regular old white-collar job, you need to have courage as well. In the audit industry, there's so many times that we're going to have something to say that's not going to be popular, and people aren't going to want to hear what we have to say. But you have to have those tough conversations, and you have to have those in person. So you can talk to them about the risks and the types of things that they need to do to protect their organization. And sometimes doing that becomes personally risky for you. But if you're not willing to do that, especially in my role, if you're a chief audit executive and you're not willing to have those tough conversations, then you shouldn't be in that role. You should always be willing to lose your job over the right cause. I really believe that. The other thing from a leader perspective is praising staff publicly. And I had my former boss, actually, a terrific role model. He's the former IG here, Jim Cornell. He would always say to me, Terry, you always need to praise staff publicly and counsel them privately. And that, while that's such a simple phrase, it's so important. A lot of times you end up hearing what bad job you've done in front of your team members, and that's so demoralizing. And so you need to have that conversation with them still. You don't let people off the hook. You need to hold them accountable, but you do it privately. And I think that they appreciate that. And as long as it's couched in a way that you give them steps to be able to improve their performance, it works out well for everybody. The other thing is that there's nothing worse than working for a leader who takes all the credit when things are great and points fingers when the things go wrong. I mean, people don't respect that. So I think another cornerstone of effective leadership and making sure you have a great organization is, and this is all free things. These are things you can do free, doesn't require, you know, acquire resources. Give the team credit when something goes well. But when it doesn't, and, you know, something goes wrong with that project, and the boss calls you in or the audit committee calls you in, you need to take personal responsibility for it. That's what leaders do. And the other thing is that I think that, one of the things we need to be mindful to make sure that we do maintain this effective organization is constantly being vigilant about ensuring your organization stays effective by doing continuous improvement. Constantly look for things that you can tighten up, that you can do a little better, you can be a little more efficient. Especially as an audit organization, it gives you a lot more credibility with the auditees because they see that you're walking the walk and you're not just out there with hypocrisy telling them to do things that you're not doing yourself. So I think those are the three questions I would ask myself.
Well, those are pretty in-depth questions and answers, really adding so many dimensions to this dialogue, and I thank you for that. Well, Terry, we are at the end of the interview, and I know you have people knocking at your door. In fact, probably the Speaker of the House right now. So.
Well, he's on recess, so I don't think there's a risk of that.
So, you know, we're really fortunate to have you come in to do this interview and share many of your insights, and especially with somebody with your position, really the highest position possible, and with your incredible career and history of success. So thank you for sharing your deep experience with our audience.
Thank you so much for having me today, Steve, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and to your audience.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with the Honorable Terry Graffenstein, Inspector General, U.S. House of Representatives.